Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. And this morning, I'm happy. 13 years ago last month, I don't truthfully think I could have said that I'm happy. When I first came into Al-Anon, I didn't need to be here, and I didn't want to be here. Today, I can say I want to be here, and I need to be here. To kind of qualify myself a little bit for the position that I stand up here in now, I didn't come from a religious background family. My parents never went to church other than for funerals or weddings. I also didn't come from an alcoholic home. My home that I grew up in was probably the most normal home of anyone around, you know. Well, there was four of us children. I was the oldest. My parents loved us. We could tell by their actions. We were just loved. There was no abuse of alcohol. There was always alcohol around. So I've always had a relationship with alcohol. My dad would make homebrew, and there's been a time or two he'd set it up a little green underneath the kitchen table, or, you know, and he'd blow bottles and what have you and make misses. But there was never any abuse of it. And there was always cold bottles of the homebrew in the spring house. And Dad always told my brothers and I, if we wanted something to drink, get that out of the spring house. Don't go out and get someone to buy something for us. Don't get in trouble with it. If we did, call him after we got out of jail would be the only thing. So, you know, there was really no, if we wanted a cold homebrew, we just got it, you know. And I started out, and I was the only one that done this, when I was in grade school, for some reason I started going to church with some neighbors. And I got involved in that church to the point that I wanted to be a minister. And all through high school, that was what I was my goal. I wanted to be a minister. I was looking to that. That's what I was studying in high school, what courses I could take. I wanted to be a minister. But also during high school, another little relationship with alcohol, I became employed for a gentleman on a Friday night. I could park my car at the Bond Steel Lumber Company in Branson, Missouri, and that's where I grew up at, and leave it for about 30 minutes and come back, and the back end of my old Chevrolet be sitting way down low to the ground, and I'd drive 32 miles to Harrison, Arkansas, and park it in the parking lot of the high school there, and walk off about 30 minutes and come back, and there'd be my car sitting back up level, and there'd be a $20 bill laying in the front seat. Now, I can truthfully say I never knew what I hauled to Harrison, Arkansas, but I know what Mr. Craig done for a living. And he measured his corn crop by the gallon and not by the bushel like everybody else. So I was involved with alcohol then. Enabling? How many people did I enable by hauling what I did to Harrison, Arkansas? I don't know. You know, I've affected, you know, my actions affected alcoholics all my life. When I got out of high school, my parents couldn't afford to send me on to college, and I couldn't afford to go on my own to be what I wanted. And I just started working, and I gave up on this idea of being a minister. And the farther away from this idea I got, the farther away I got away from this God that I knew then, and became more self-controlling of my life and those around me. And the farther I got from God, the more controlling and selfish, I guess you would say, that I became. Well, I met I met a young lady, and we dated for a while, and we finally got married, and children started coming along, and I never understood this woman. The best way I can describe her is she was crazy. I really didn't know much about her family. I'd only met her family twice before we got married. I was from Branson. She was over there working and going to the School of the Ozarks, which was a school for underprivileged children, a high school at the time. And her parents lived over at Donovan, Missouri, which was down in a boot hill. So I never made any trips to Donovan, Missouri. So. But this woman was just crazy. And some of the things that she would do, she was loud, she was abusive, she was argumentative, she abused our children right from the time the first one was born. But I did not understand this woman. I just did not understand her. No matter how hard I tried to control her and my surroundings, it did not work. It just didn't work. Well, it wound up that I left Branson before the big to-do, and they swiped all the stars from Nashville now, and they're all up there. But I left there before that, and I moved to Central Missouri, and I wound up with a job which was perfect for someone that had some control issues. I wound up on the Columbia, Missouri Police Department, and that's great, you know. I could control my surroundings. I could control the people around me because we had handcuffs and nightsticks and jails and flights of stairs they could fall down and all these different things that we could use to control people. And it was great. While I was on the police department, I still didn't know. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. When I was on the police department, we had the North A Street town drunks. And every Friday or Saturday night, you'd pick these poor guys up and haul them to jail for drunk in the public view, put them in the city jail. Monday morning, the judge would fine them $10 or 2 days in jail, credit time served, and turn them loose. And you'd start all over on Friday and Saturday night. There was nothing ever said about alcoholism. I just knew they drank a lot, and they was always there. They was always the same place. The good thing about it was when you pick them up like that, especially in the wintertime, they had 2 nights of warm place to sleep and 2 good meals for the day that they was in there. We was always in these bars and clubs breaking up fights, and there was always alcohol and broken bottles and all this kind of stuff. But there was one place in Columbia, it was called the ABC Club, and I never knew what that was. I spent all those years that I spent on the Columbia Police Department and never knew till 30 years later that I wind up being involved with AA and Al-Anon. I find out what the ABC Club was. It was an Al-Anon club. They had AA and Al-Anon meetings there. And I always thought when I was on the police department, they must have some mighty big bouncers because we never get a call there. Every night of the week there was cars there just like there was all the other nightclubs and the bars, but we never got a call there. And I never knew what that was till I came into this program and I found out. Well, this marriage to this lady and the 3 kids and things, it broke up. And there was a lot of turmoil, visitation with the children. There was times I would go that she moved to the next county where her parents had moved to at the time. And I'd go to pick up my 3 children on visitation days, and I've been met with a deer rifle at the door, and I've been arrested for being there creating disturbances. When I could prove that I was doing my job on such a night, you know, and things. Just a lot of this craziness went on, and it was from both of us. It was from both of us, because I didn't know how to react to this woman. Before I came into this program, and I finally thought that the life I was leading was normal and the life I came from was abnormal. Because everybody I was involved with, through on the police department, you get a call to go to a residence. It's usually a disturbance. 99.99% of the time, alcohol was involved. That seemed normal. Everything just seemed normal. I met another young lady, and of course we dated, and she had some problems, and I knew I could take care of them and fix them, and of course we wound up being married. And there was two daughters came out of this marriage, and it was the same type thing. It was the same woman, just a different face that sat across the table every night at supper. Argumentative, combative, disagreeable, didn't want to do what I wanted. I did not understand. And she didn't drink, just like the other one. She didn't. And I've always thought, maybe if they did drink, now that I've been in here, maybe things would have been different. But they didn't drink. Well, that went on for about 4 years, I guess. And those two children came along, and it got worse, and it got worse. I loved those kids. And after that marriage broke up, I'd done something that I have regretted for years. I got to thinking that I could control those two daughters' lives and make their lives better than what the lives was of the three from the first marriage, so I gave those two up for adoption. And I've regretted that since. But that was, at the time, I thought that was the best thing I could do for those girls, so they wouldn't have to see the arguments on weekends when I was supposed to pick them up, the arguments when I took them back, the complaints over child support, and all of this. So I gave those children up. And of course, it wasn't too long till, you know, there's another one over here, you know, that I need, or she needs me, or we need each other, we wound up getting married. You know? And again, it's the same woman. Different face. She don't drink. She's crazy. She's irrational. She's argumentative. She's abusive. I do not understand this. I just cannot get this. You know, no matter what I do, I cannot get this woman any way, shape, or form. Well, during this period in time, this marriage breaks up, and I'm controlling my life so terribly well and doing just fine, thank you. I'm making house payments on two houses. I'm working two full-time jobs. I'm working for the Columbia Police Department, midnight shift. I get off at 7 o'clock in the morning. I change my clothes. I go to work at Columbia Ice and Storage, and I spend 8 hours in an ice plant. And I get off there at 5 o'clock, and I change clothes, and I work for the city tax assessor's office, and I work 2 hours an evening for the city tax assessor's office. And then I change clothes, and I go back to work for the police department. So I've got 2.5 jobs. I'm making house payments. I own two houses. But I'm controlling my life so well, I'm homeless and living in my car. I couldn't even get a post office box number. You got to have a permanent address to get a post office box. You know how humiliating it is to get a letter from your mother and it's addressed to you, Paul Neal, Columbia Police Department? Mail that's sent to the guys back in jail that I'd arrested the night before, maybe. Joe Blow, Columbia Police Department. The poor mailman probably thought, he's in there an awful lot. You know, then I wound up leaving the police department. I had some health problems, and I wound up leaving the police department. And before I left the police department, when I was still there, and I was still holding down these jobs and homeless, the guy that owned the ice plant, winter was coming on, and he was feeling sorry for me, and he offered me a little room, and I called it the Coldwater Flat. And it was up on the fifth floor of the ice plant. And the room was about twice the size of that piano. And it had one of these cloth army cots in it. And it had a stool in the corner. And somebody had put a makeshift shower in. And it was a cold water shower. You don't have much hot water in ice plants. And at least it was a little warmer than outside in the wintertime sleeping in your car. But on my nights off from the police department, if I happened to be out and come in after 5 o'clock, the way to get to my cold water flat was I went up a ladder on a tower at the back of the ice plant where they had these big long tubes that ice would be froze over the outside, and then they'd release it and it would come down pre-crushed. And so I'd climb this ladder like 2.5 stories up and then cross over onto the roof of the main ice plant and scurry across the roof and then up another ladder 2 stories and in through a window and then down to my room. Well, many years later, I wind up in Al-Anon meetings with a young lady whose father owned the ice plant. And she told me one time, she heard me tell my story at a birthday meeting. And she told me, she said, I always thought my brother, who her brother's like 5 years older than her, was scaring me. He always kept telling me about this man that would scurry around late at night on the roof of the ice plant. And she said, I was always afraid to go upstairs in the ice plant for afraid this guy would get me. And here I sit in meetings with her. You know? Well, eventually I wound up with a little apartment. And after I left the police department then, I moved to Phoenix, Arizona for a while. And then I couldn't stand that, so I came back to Columbia, Missouri. And, of course, I wind up meeting another lady. Now, I know some of you are counting, and I'm not even up to Debbie yet. And this lady and I worked at the same place. I was working doing what I do now. I was doing maintenance work, and I was also working at a Kmart and security. And I met this lady, and we started dating, and she drank to the excess. And I knew this, but we wound up getting married anyway, you know. But at least she was different than the others. I could understand why she would argue when she was drunk, because all these guys that I'd picked up when I was on the police, they always argued when they was drunk. They wanted to fight when they was drunk. She wanted to fight when she was drunk. So I could kind of understand that. This started me to do a lot of that real crazy stuff that I did. And I put myself in some positions that, because of someone else's abuse of alcohol, that I don't think I would have put myself in if it hadn't been for that. This lady had an uncle, an aunt that lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And her uncle had died, and we were going to go at the funeral. And I got off work at Kmart and closed the place up at 10 o'clock at night, and we hit the roads, and I start driving to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And wifey is sitting in the passenger seat and she's drinking all the way there. And by the time we get to Milwaukee, and I've drove all night, and we get in there the next day, I don't know where I'm going. And she's so intoxicated, she don't either. So I find a place that I can get coffee and orange juice, and I start pouring this down her. And by the time I get her coherent enough that she can tell me where we need to go, and we get there, the funeral's over, her aunt has left town with a cousin, and there's just us. So it's time to start home, because I had to be to work the next day. You know, I got to drive. I'm off. Luckily, I'm off that day. I had to drive to be home to go to work the next morning. Well, of course, vehicles don't run without gas, and we pulled into a little quick shop thing, and I fill the car up with gas and go to the restroom, and when I come out, wife and car is gone, and I still owe for a tank full of gas, and I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I hitchhike from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, through Chicago, St. Louis, Missouri, and I make it to Columbia, Missouri, in time to go to work at 10 o'clock the next morning. Now, I came through the interstates on Chicago, which brings me mighty close to some of the areas up there that ambulances and police cars don't even like to go into. I came through St. Louis. The interstates run through some very bad parts of town. This God that I found in this program, this God in my understanding that I didn't know anything about, was taking care of me back then when I couldn't even take care of myself. I made it home in time to go to work the next day, and wife came home 3 days later. I hope she had a good time. I never mentioned it. I never brought it up. I don't want an argument. I don't want to fight. Because if it's brought up, there will be an argument, there will be a fight. And we just went on like normal, the everyday fights and battles. The normal stuff. It was normal. I was working on the car. It was in July one day, and I was working on the car, and it was hot. And she came out and handed me this big, tall glass. With something yellow in it and ice cubes, and it was sweating on the outside, and it looked, and I drank with this lady somewhat. Now, I'm not much of a drinker, but she brought this out to me, and it tasted cool, and it was wet, and I was thirsty, and I started drinking it. And when I opened my eyes, I'm laying in a hospital bed thinking, what am I at? And it's 3 days later. The police had been called, ambulance had been called, I'd been hauled to the hospital, I'd been poisoned. Samples had been sent to the highway patrol, they couldn't find what was in it, but they had said I'd been poisoned. And whether she'd done this on purpose with something, because she always had pills of every kind around. She had all these imaginary diseases, and all every doctor in the city of Columbia had treated her for severe stomach pain and prescribed stuff, and that went along with her alcohol. I don't know what was in that. But I had what today I laughingly say was my first spiritual awakening. It was time to get out of that marriage. And I got out. And I, at the time then, I was working full-time doing maintenance work. And I'd went to work for this company that owned some rental properties off out in the west edge of the city of Columbia, and the secretary had sent me out to this place to replace a toilet seat. And I go out there, and I've never been to that area before, never been out there, and I knock at the door, and the door is opened by the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my life, and it was love at first sight. And there she stood. Her hair was matted and full of vomit, and she stunk. This house coat she had on was one of the polyester or whatever it is. If you get it too close to flame, it just kind of and turns black around the edges. But she needed me, and I needed her. And we started this thing, and I laugh and torment her about it. It seemed like I was there every day because it was something broke, and I torment her about her breaking stuff to get the maintenance man back. But, you know, there was a light above the kitchen stove, the range hood, and she was living with her mom at the time. And then there was the fan switch for the range hood above the kitchen stove. And then there was the electric meter being pulled off the side of the house at the back. Now, I don't know how she ever managed that one, but we developed a relationship. And we drank together. And this was we used November deer season as the anniversary of when we met, because that's when it was. Now, what day, I don't know. I just know deer season is the second week of November, so it was sometime in there. And I came from the school that my dad done it, my brother's done it, my uncle's done it, that we deer hunt. We always had a half-pint bottle of peach brandy in your hip pocket, because that was the spare gloves. You know, you get cold fingers standing out there, just a sip, that's all it takes. And one time, Debbie and I was having a little peach, and I had a cup of coffee. And she said, "Do you want a little of that in your coffee?" And why ruin a good cup of coffee? Because I didn't understand the way she drank. She didn't understand the way I drank. And we've had that discussion many, many times. But we developed this relationship, and eventually we moved in together. And as this relationship progressed, Debbie's drinking, it seemed to me like, progressed. We drank together, but her drinking got worse. And there was times, you know, we'd maybe go to barbecue, well, a little beer and a barbecue sauce. Well, we didn't have any because it had all been drank the night before with everything else that was in the house. So I'd go buy a six-pack of beer. I'd put a little beer and a barbecue sauce, and I would drink the rest of the can, and Debbie drank the rest of it. And we didn't have beer for the barbecue sauce the next night, you know. So we had our discussions about her drinking, and I was punished for that. She mentioned it last night. If I talked to her about her drinking, I was punished. That didn't stop me from wanting to have these discussions with her about it. I just could not understand why she could drink like that. And how she could drink like that. When the first time that Debbie was hospitalized, and I was sitting on the edge of the bed when the doctor told her, "Debbie, you can never drink again." And I thought, this is it. I don't have to do it no more. She's going to quit drinking, because any prudent person, if a doctor tells them to do something, they're going to do it. Because many years ago, I was working in a place, I was working for Branson Novelty Manufacturing, and 8 hours a day I sat in a little tiny room and I sanded and sawed walnuts, and the dust was thick, and I couldn't wear a mask because my glasses would steam over, and then I'd get my fingers into the bandsaw or the sanders, so I just had to tough it out. And I was smoking 2.5 to 3 packs of Camels unfiltered a day. And I developed some lung problems, and I went to the old doctor, and our family doctor, and he said, "Well, you either need to quit smoking or you need to quit working there, because it's one or the other, or the combination is causing your problems." Well, I went home that night, and at 10 o'clock I smoked the last cigarette I had, February the 13th, 1961, and I gave 2 weeks notice the next morning, and it cleared up. So when a doctor tells me to do something, I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. So when the doctor told Debbie she had to quit drinking, she's going to quit drinking. Well, when she said last night that 3 months that she was dry there was the worst of her life, they definitely was the worst of my life. It was actually, if I look back on it, it was kind of a relief when she did start drinking. I never noticed. It was it's kind of a subtle change, but she got a little better for some. And, you know, I thought, well, maybe it's because she's not drinking. She will get better over time. But I pulled into the little quick shop, which very handily they built less than a block from our house, and they had all this stuff behind the counter, you know. And I pulled in there one evening and my way in from work and filled up with gas, and I went in this quick shop, and the young lady working in there, she says, "Mr. Neal, I'm mad at you. What did I do? Why are you mad at me?" And she said, "Well, your wife was up here today and bought 2 gallon jugs of wine and said you was having a party tonight, and you didn't invite me." Okay. Debbie's not drinking. We're not having a party that I know of, and I don't like wine. So I go home and I start looking, you know, and it's not hard to find. When Debbie's drinking and I don't have all of her faculties about her, if I can go and open her closet door and there's a pair of these boots that the ladies wore that wrinkled down around the ankle when they got them on, if hers is standing up in the closet, there's a fifth of vodka in them. Or you pull the linen closet door open and there's a big gallon-shaped lump under one towel. It's easy to find. If all the cases that I'd worked when I finally wound up being in the detective bureau when I was on the police department, if all the cases that I had worked was as easy to solve as they was finding her bottles, Columbo, Kojak, none of them guys would have had a thing on me. We had more discussions. And the more we discussed it there again, the more I was punished. And she was starting to look bad. And I dragged her to the hospitals and they tell my family, her family and myself, that Debbie's probably not going to live through the night. And she, they'd patch her up and she'd get better and we'd come home. And it was the same thing, same thing, and same thing. She mentioned it briefly last night. We'd had a discussion and she said, I'm just going to go do it on my own. I said, well, I'll take you. You know, I'm going to go. She calls the cab and leaves. Before the cab gets there, I know where she's at because I call the same cab company. And say, you sent a cab to my house and I give the address. I just need to know where it's going because I need to contact my wife. Well, they tell me. She's gone to Boone County Hospital up on the psych ward for however many days it was. I knew where she was at before she got there. That's how bad I wanted to control her drinking. And while she was gone, of course, I took the house apart. I dumped out everything I could find. And I found it in places that I'd never found before. And she was there and came home, and of course, she drank again. You know. It got continually worse, continually, continually, continually worse. Of course, it was our secret. It was in our house. You know, there's been times that there's been at our house, there's been police cars out front, there's been ambulances out front, and there's been fire trucks out front. Because when you call for an ambulance, in Columbia, they send everybody. And they don't come around the street, creep around the corner with their lights out. They all come with red lights and sirens. But our neighbors was deaf and blind. They didn't see this, and they didn't hear it. It was our secret. We danced it in the house. Family knew. It was hard to keep from it. You know, it was during this time that I became a thief. I stole her alcohol and poured it down the drain. I became a liar, a big liar. Her sister would call and say, I need to speak to Debbie. Well, she's out with your mom this afternoon. Her mom would call and say, I want to speak to Debbie. Well, she's out with Kathy this afternoon. Well, I got caught. They were together and called one to speak to Debbie, and I told her sister, she's out with your mom, and mom's sitting there, you know, so that didn't work anymore. I'd go to work, and Debbie would, sometimes was able to work, and sometimes not, but I'd go to work, and people would say, well, where's your partner at today? Well, she's homesick with the flu. Well, Debbie had the flu for 7 years, basically. But, On October the 5th, early in the morning, I get this call from the Army base in Fort Hood, Texas, telling me that my oldest daughter is seriously ill and they can't do anything for her, and they're shipping her to Scott White Medical Center in Temple, Texas, which is 60 miles away, and they give her a 50-50 chance to live to get there. And 40 minutes later, I get a call from the doctor at that hospital telling me that my oldest daughter had just died. And that was rough. It was really, really rough. But before this happened, the lady that her, the couple that lived next door to us, and unbeknownst, they were both in the AA program and practicing the program and going to meetings and things. And she met me out in the yard one day and she handed me this book. And I have other copies of this, but this is my favorite. You can see it's, you know, but I have special attachment to this one. And Donna told me if I would read this book and go to Al-Anon meetings. I hadn't heard that word. I'd heard of AA because it had been mentioned that Debbie needed to attend AA, and once in a while she would go to an AA meeting, but as she mentioned, she was drunk when somebody would take her. She told me if I would read this book and go to Al-Anon meetings would help me with Debbie's drinking. Now that's what she said. What I heard was, if I would read this book and go to Al-Anon meetings, they would help me stop Debbie's drinking. I went to an AA meeting one time with Debbie. She found we'd had a disagreement, and always about the same thing, of course, it comes in a bottle. But she said, well, I'll go to an AA meeting if you will take me. Well, we went to this meeting, and I knew nothing about closed meetings, and she knew nothing about closed meetings, and we go up these stairs in this church, and we're sitting in this semi-circle thing in this meeting, and they're going around, and, you know, the people, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, and they come to Debbie, and she says, well, my name is Debbie, and I drink too much, and come to me, and I said, I'm just here with her. And you thought the world was coming to an end. I was politely told we had to leave, and I was escorted out the door. That was my first AA meeting. I didn't want none of them people either after that. So I decided, when Donna told me if I would go to Al-Anon, I didn't go. I waited. It was, I don't know how long it was after she told me, but things got worse. They got to the point that I finally decided I couldn't do it on my own. I could not stop Debbie's drinking on my own. And I decided to go to an Al-Anon meeting. So I get the local paper and I look in there, and there's a section called Looking Ahead, and they got all these meetings listed. And I look in there and, you know, there's 8 o'clock, United Methodist Church, Al-Anon meeting. Well, I go. Pull in the parking lot a little before 8, you know. I don't need to be there. I don't want to be there. And I sat in that parking lot for an hour, and the church is dark. Nobody shows up. And I have a resentment. Of course, I don't know what resentments are at the time, but, you know, if that's the way they run their classes to teach you how to get an alcoholic or a drunk to quit drinking, no wonder there's so many of them out there. The teachers don't show up. They don't unlock the building. Well, I go home, and I look in the paper again, and it's Looking Ahead, it says. Well, I read the paper on Tuesday night. I go to the meeting on Tuesday night, but the meeting is on Thursday night. I go back on Thursday night. And I wait to just before they pull the door closed before I dart in this place. And they close the door, and I'm cooped up in this little room with about 12 or 14 women. And I thought, oh my God. It's because of a woman that I'm here, and now I'm shut up in a room for an hour with all these women, and they're going to take her part. Well, they didn't. And they came, you know, I don't know what was said that night. I remember just before I bolted, like the deer in the headlights, out the door, they gave me a hug and said, keep coming back. And I kept going back, I kept going back. And I wasn't a participant. I took up a chair. I was there. I took up a space. One of the first things that I remember them telling me, and it made me mad, they told me I was enabling my alcoholic. And I couldn't understand, how in the hell can I be enabling her? I'm not buying any alcohol. I'm dumping out all I can find. And one elderly lady that was there and still comes there said, you're not allowing her to reach her bottom. If she has to drink to reach her bottom, let her reach her bottom. And I said, but if she drinks, she's going to die. Because I'd heard the doctors tell her that. More times than once, more times than twice. And she said, that may be her bottom. She may have to die. And I did not understand that. But I kept going to these meetings, and I kept going to these meetings, and I was getting some of this stuff by osmosis, and I was reading this, and finally, when I started looking at the steps, I realized I had taken the first part of the first step before I ever went, because I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. That's why I went there, because I couldn't do it. I'd done everything in my power. And that part of that first step about my life being unmanageable, I have learned since. My life wasn't unmanageable. It just needed a new manager, not me. That God, in my understanding that I found in those meetings and those steps, was of my understanding. I'm going to back up a little bit. In these marriages that I was in, I married into a Methodist church, and I'd done all the studying and the books and done everything that was necessary, and I was baptized into the Methodist church. I did not understand that God of their understanding. That marriage broke up, and when I married the second time, I married into a Presbyterian church. Same thing. I'd done the studying. I'd done the test that was given. I was emerged in the water. I did not understand that God. It was a God of their understanding. The third marriage, I married into a Jehovah's Witness church. They don't baptize. The fourth one was Southern Baptist. This lady drank, but that was all right. You know, we went to church. But I done the studying. I took the test. I was immersed by a one-legged minister. In cold water, they had just filled the thing up that morning and hadn't turned the heater. It was cold, let me tell you. He had on a rubber boot, and I didn't. But that was a God of their understanding, not of my understanding. And I found that God in here of my understanding. I didn't know anyone outside of those 12 or 13 women that was in that meeting. And I didn't know all of them by name. I knew faces. I know her. She goes to that meeting and I go to. The people on down the hallway and around the corner that was in the AA program, I didn't know any of them because they went in and out a different door than we went in and out. So I never seen them. I didn't know any of them people. I didn't want to know them people. Because I still didn't need to be there. Well, when my daughter passed away, I come from a large family. There's a lot of, it's going to be a lot of people there. It's going to be a military funeral because she was in the United States Army. There was people like they do, they bring food, they bring stuff to the house and things, and there were people showed up with food and stuff. I had no idea who these people were. I knew they weren't the neighbors because we knew the neighbor across the street and knew the neighbor that lived here because he was the doctor that went to the medical center that worked there and he was my doctor. I could just walk across the lawns And the people that was in the AA program here, basically that was our neighbors. You knew them because you'd see them. Not by name, but you'd see them. So all these people bringing food and stuff, and paper towels and paper plates, and family was coming from out of town, so they wasn't bringing it. I know now who they were. They were you all. They were the people in that Al-Anon meeting. They were the people from the other Al-Anon meetings that was in town at the time. They were the people from the AA meetings. I had became a member of the Al-Anon family group without even trying. And I didn't know it. I did not know it. But today I do. And I will always be eternally grateful to them people. The day of, and I knew, I hadn't worked the steps, but I'd read, you know, make amends. I'd heard people talk about that and things. I'd been in that program 6 months when my daughter died, and at the cemetery at my daughter's funeral, my ex-wife and her second husband and my two daughters that I had gave up for adoption show up after 16 years. They come back into the, they're there. And of course, during his time after I gave them up, I cannot have any contact with them because I'm going against a court order if I do. You know, I'm a policeman and an ex-policeman, and I'm trying to be an abiding citizen, and I'm not going to do anything like that. So I don't. I made an amend of sorts at the graveside to those two girls. I told them I was sorry for what I had done. I regretted what I had done. And I would always love them, and that I still loved them. When Debbie went to treatment then, she said last night, she came home and fell in a bathtub, and she was a terrible mess on the bed. And I had got to this point. I finally, I've always heard it in here, let go and let God and turn it over to God. And I came to trust that God of my understanding. I stood in the hallway and just looked up, and I remember saying, God, I can't do this anymore. And then when I went to the bedroom and told Debbie, you know, if she didn't do something about her drinking, I was going to have to leave. You know, we had had that discussion many times before. I had told her, God, I don't know how many times I'd told her that. I never meant it, and I think she knew I didn't mean it. That night she heard it. It was like 2:00 in the morning. And I turned around and walked out of the bedroom, and the next thing I know, she's in the little room I use as an office for our business across the hall from the bed. And she's back there on the phone talking to someone. And when she hangs up, she tells me it's at a little treatment center down in Herman, Missouri. And they're coming to get her the next morning at 9:00. And she said, they said you should get me a bottle. Oh, yeah? They're going to have to tell me. The phone call was made, and the gal down at the treatment center says, yes, we do not want her going into DTs. We want to detox her in a controlled environment. Well, this is 2:30 in the morning. The bars is closed. The grocery stores, even the 24-hour ones, can't sell from midnight to 7:00 in the morning. Or to 11:00 in the morning. So we suffer this night out, and at 7:00 in the morning, I go to this grocery store whom I've known the manager from since he was a little bitty boy. His father was on the highway patrol stationed in the district where Columbia's at. I've watched him grow from a bag boy in a grocery store up to he's the manager of this store. And I go in there, and I humble myself to this man. I tell him what my problem is and what I need. And he says, we know. How did they? But he said, I can't sell you anything, Paul. Here's a brown paper sack. Go get what you need and come back after 11:00 when I can ring it up, because it shows up on the cash register tapes. We come to find, how do they know? You know, when you take a shopping cart with a few groceries and 2 or 3 gallon jugs of wine through the checkout every other day, they know. There was a gal that checked us out that I had known from when I was on the police department. I used to go out there and pick up the bad checks at the grocery store, and I'd known this lady for years. And when Debbie and I went to our first state AA convention in Columbia, which was the following year after she got sober, we walked in there, and guess who was standing there? there's Jean standing there with her name tag on and AFG. And she gave us both a hug and said, I wondered how long it would be before you two showed up here. She had watched us for years. It was our secret. Nobody knew. But when Debbie went to treatment, and then when she came back, I was going to this one little Al-Anon meeting a week with all these ladies, and I'm the only man there, you know, and have been all this time. Debbie starts going to all these meetings that she picked out, that she's going to. And I'm going to my one meeting a week. And the rest of the nights that she's gone, I'm sitting at home, and she's gone, and I think, man, ain't this a bitch? She's sober, and I'm sitting here alone, at least when she was drinking, because Debbie, she never went to bars. She drank at home. She was always at home. This guy, to my understanding, has a very peculiar sense of humor. She said last night, there was eventually a man started coming with his wife coming into the Al-Anon program, and they came because of their daughter. And when Debbie mentioned last night about the doctors telling her family that she was going to die, we was in the hospital the night that this couple that started coming to Al-Anon, when the doctors told them their daughter was going to die that night, we was with them when she died that night. So we know firsthand what it was like, you know, for them to be told. I know what it was like firsthand, for them to be told their daughter's going to die that night. We see all this stuff, and I read this stuff, and I hear this stuff, the things that can happen to an alcoholic. You know, they can either get sober, they can be institutionalized with wet brain, they can be intoxicated and go to jail. That night, or they can die. That night at the hospital, we've seen it all, right there in the emergency room. There was the young lady that died of the disease of alcoholism. There was Debbie that was sober. There was the brother of the young lady that died's boyfriend. He was home from an institution because he had wet brain from alcoholism on a weekend furlough. And while we was there, the police brought another guy in that's in and out of the AA program to have him patched up so they could haul him to jail, and he was drunk. So it was all right there in the emergency room that one night. But this sense of humor that my God has, this couple that wanted to help their daughter, wanted to start a place, a club, so they could have meetings to help their daughter. And I don't know if Carol was ever there more than twice at the very most, hated it. But we got involved. We got involved in that club, and I got involved. And we was there 7 nights a week. We would leave the Thursday night meeting that I'd go to, or the other meeting, somebody would drop Debbie off there, and we was there 7 nights a week till whatever time the last people left. We was always the last people to leave, clean up and gone. But I started getting better. And eventually I started an Al-Anon meeting at that club. And then I started an Alateen meeting there at that club. We have a little pamphlet in Al-Anon. It's called When I Got Busy, I Got Better. And I love that little book. And I think because when I get busy doing that kind of stuff and doing service work, I don't have time to live in my own head. That's my own worst enemy, is my head. The committee up there don't function like other committees. None of them agrees. We kept doing that, and I got involved there, and I've stayed in Al-Anon. And since I've been in Al-Anon, I have been everything from treasurer of a group to group rep to district alternate. I'm the only living member of the original founding fathers of this Al-Anon club. I'm still there. I'm still the general manager, secretary, treasurer. And this has been 12 years. I stay busy in the program. The things that this program and the other program has allowed us to do, and it's because of you all. We wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for that. Since I've been in this program, I've learned what alcoholism is. And I've learned to see the signs of it. And maybe I can't say that that person is an alcoholic, but I can see the problems. Like wife number four, the one that did drink. I can't say she's an alcoholic. She's been arrested 3 times for DWI, 2 times for leaving the scene of an accident, 1 time for resisting arrest. At one time, I talked to her daughter, and the paramedics was afraid to even try to move her out of her apartment for fear she was going to die before they could even get her out. They wanted her stable on the floor. Now, I can't say this lady's an alcoholic. She's the only one who said. I can say she definitely has a problem. Go back to wife number one, the first one that didn't drink. I found out after I come in here, she came from a very abusive alcoholic home. Her father and mother both were very abusive to all their children. Her father drank to the excess. Her sister is probably dying today from the disease of alcoholism, the last we heard. All of her brothers, there was five of them, have all had problems with drug and alcohol abuse. The next to the youngest brother is in the state penitentiary in the state of California right now, serving a sentence for kicking and stomping his mother to the point that she died, and he's serving a charge of murder because she wouldn't give him her Social Security check so he could go and buy more alcohol. That's the family wife number one came from. She was affected by alcohol, and it came all the way through. And she carried it on and passed it on. Wife number two, she didn't drink. They lived on a farm, and I used to enjoy my days off from the police department. I'd go over, and I loved working on the farm and working there. But I always wondered about all of these empty little bottles that was up in the hayloft of the barn, and you'd slam on the brakes of the old grain truck, and all these bottles would cascade out from underneath the seat. Well, I know now, her father drank a lot. Her older sister's husband is still in prison for alcohol-related offenses. Her older brother, the last time I talked to her younger sister, the family had no idea where he was at. He'd lost his wife, he'd lost his job, his kids. He just disappeared. He had no idea where he was at. She was affected by alcoholism, untreated. She knew no other way. Wife number three, we were divorced at the time, but I went to her father's funeral. He died of alcoholism. Her stepfather is one of the guys we see today on the streets of Columbia, Missouri, wandering around with a brown bottle in his hand, or a brown bag with a bottle in it. And his address is Streets of Columbia. Her brothers, all of her brothers, have been incarcerated for alcohol-related offenses at some time or other. She got two of them in prison right now. One of them is serving a sentence for, in a drunken stupor, beating his girlfriend's little 2-year-old son to death. Another one just got sent back not too long ago for his 5th DWI offense. She didn't drink. She was affected by alcoholism. She carried it on. She passed it on. She didn't know any better. I knew nothing of that disease when I came out of my family. And it's kind of ironic. There's 4 of us kids And between the four of us, there's 12 marriages. My parents were married 56 years, I think, when my dad passed away. Myself, my brothers, and my sister always wound up with someone, either ex-wives or relations, with someone that had an alcohol problem, or they came from an alcoholic home, or have alcoholic relatives of some kind. I don't know whether we have a gene that says if you don't come from an alcoholic home, you got to have one. I found mine, you know. I jokingly say, you know, the wives with me is kind of like fishing. Eventually, you're going to get a keeper, and that was mentioned earlier. That's my keeper. We have been and done more in the last 13 years than I had done in the first 49 years before I came in here. I have one grandson. We're kind of putting a chair to the side and reserving it for him, because I think if he ever takes a drink, he will be here. And he will be a member of the other fellowship, because he's got all the isms that goes along. He just hasn't taken the drink. His grandfather on the other side died in a hospital because of alcohol-related diseases. So it's there. The life I have today, I would not trade for anything. The two daughters that I hadn't seen while Debbie was in treatment, one of them wrote me a 9-page letter and wanted to meet with me. We made arrangements. I met with her at the Dairy Queen down the street from us. She brought her fiance at the time. We talked for several hours. She's been in and out over the last 12, 13 years. She'll call, she'll write, she'll come by, they'll come by, you know, and she's now divorced and remarried again, and they moved just past spring, they moved to Florida. She's around. There is a relationship that's starting to build. The other daughter has never come around yet. Who knows? Maybe she will, maybe she won't. Since Debbie and I have been in a program, the relationship that I have with my other kids also has improved. Used to be they didn't want to come by. Now then, even the grandkids, you know, the ones that live up by Chicago, they're ready to come to Papa and Debbie's anytime. When can we go back? And they ain't even home yet from being there the last time. It makes me feel good. People are comfortable in our house today. People didn't used to be comfortable in our house today. I'm comfortable in our house today. I'm not saying we don't have problems. We do. Every bed of roses has thorns. We try our best to work the things out. I'm not, I don't work a perfect program. I'm not perfect. It took me 49 years of sickness to get here, and I've only been getting better for 13. If I can keep getting better, and life keeps getting better, I don't know as I could stand it. And this woman that was love at first sight, that she needed me and I needed her, definitely today, I need her and I love her more every day. And it's because of her disease that I'm here. So today, I can truthfully say, I'm grateful for my alcoholic. And I used to hear these little old ladies in this meeting say that, and I thought, God, how can they say that? I'd be grateful if she'd quit drinking, but not grateful for her. But today I am. Today I am eternally grateful for my alcoholic. It's just beyond my imagination, the life that I have today, because of the program that I don't work perfect, but I try to work a little bit every day. And my alcoholic, and this God of my understanding. And that has been the most important thing that I've got out of this program. It's a God of my understanding He's all-loving, will take care of everything. The miracles that is performed in our lives is beyond belief. You know, I don't remember how long I was in this program, several years, and Debbie was sober, and my youngest son lived with his mother, and he started causing some problems. He's 14, 15 years old, and the police was arresting, picking him up, and every time he was arrested, there was always a case of beer handy. But he didn't have a problem. One time he was arrested, several of them, they was arrested for walking down the street, and they was breaking the fluorescent lights out of a used car dealership. Two policemen sitting there with their lights out drinking coffee watched all this. Well, my son thought they was picking on him because they got him. He just didn't run as fast as the others. That's why he got caught. Another time he was arrested, him and a couple of other kids carrying a case of beer down the street. They're 16, 15, 16 years old. They're throwing empty beer bottles against plate glass windows. Jeremy didn't understand why they should pick on him. His bottle didn't break, and it didn't break a window. Debbie told me, you got to... And I was going to Kansas City. I was going up there and talking to his mom. I was going to the juvenile office. And Debbie told me, reminded me of my program, you got to let him go. And I did. And you know, the last time he went to court, they gave him 90 days in Jackson County juvenile detention, and that's not a good place to be up there. And it hurt when I watched them put him in handcuffs and walk him down that hallway. But it helped. He came out and done great for a while. But he's back out there now. He's drinking some, and he's doing his thing. I've still let him go. His mother still calls, and I got a message on the payphone on my cell phone that I played it back last night. His mother called and he's having problems again. So, you know, I have to let him go. He has to do his thing. My ex-wife belongs in Al-Anon with this kid, but she won't do that. So this program and Debbie's program is my life today. And as I said earlier, today I want to be here, and today I need to be here. And again, I want to thank you all for sitting here and listening to me share my life and part of Debbie's life. Again, thank you.